Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And this is Carol Jurgensen Sheets. And if you were listening to Russell describe his problem, I must tell you that it went a lot deeper than what you heard on the radio. Russell did not feel like he ever got any of his needs met as a small child. And he didn't feel any real attachment to his mother or his father. As a matter of fact, he was in some ways orphaned by them, and his relatives had to take care of him. And he was shifted from relative to relative to relative. And he said, you know, Carol, I never really felt like I belonged to anybody. And he feels like his sexual addiction keeps him from feeling like he can have anybody in his life that really connects and attaches to him. And so, hey, this is the perfect topic tonight to be talking about attachment disorder. You know, I am so excited and pleased that we're going to be talking with an expert in the field, John G. Caldwell, D.O. He's a board-certified psychiatrist from the world-renowned Meadows in Arizona. And I have worked with these folks. I have used them with some of my clients. I personally have met several of the staff. And it's an amazing group of people that do some real intensive trauma work with clients who so oftentimes are at their wit's end. They've tried everything. They've been to counseling. They've been to 12-step groups. They've been to other counselors. They've been to 12-step groups. They've been to ministers and priests and pastors, and nothing seems to work. And, you know, one of the things I know as a certified sexual addictions therapist is that it is imperative that when nothing's working, you probably need more intensive treatment. And Dr. Caldwell is going to be talking about his experience with relational trauma in childhood. He's going to talk about attachment relations. I know that sounds very, very sophisticated, but in actuality, he's done some research and has participated in some research that shows distinct attachment styles. You know, whether you're feeling very, very secure or avoidant. Maybe you are very anxious, you can't stay focused, or you're preoccupied. And when you have those kind of issues, you are much more likely to use addiction to numb the void, the wounded soul, as I call it. And as a result, you develop a multitude of problems, including sexual addiction, drug or alcohol addiction, eating disorders, and if you don't have either a very safe place like the Meadows to do trauma work or an expert and skilled counselor who can do intensive work with you, you may not be able to heal those wounds. So tonight he's going to be talking about some strategies to assist you in creating less anxiety and more mindfulness. And you've heard me say it before. I talked tonight to my sexual addictions group. When you want to feel contentment, when you want to feel happiness, there are three factors that research has shown over and over again need to be present in your life to be that kind of happy person. And that happiness is created by staying in the moment. And Dr. Caldwell is going to be talking about what is mindfulness and how do you use mindfulness to work through some of those attachment issues and to self-soothe and to stay focused on what is both in and outside of the body. So if you stay in the moment and you have gratitude, which is the second factor, and you use reframing, you know, instead of looking at the bad things that have happened to you, yes, you do need to look at those. You have to acknowledge them. You have to work through them. Then you have to let them go and realize how you are a stronger, healthier person as a result. Now, this doesn't mean I'm excusing anybody who went through significant abuse, neglect, abandonment, or trauma. But I'm here to tell you, if you're listening to the show tonight and that sounds like you, you probably are not in touch with the many strengths you have because you're a survivor. And when you're a survivor, you can reframe some of your experiences and not necessarily see the good in them, but see how it created a situation where you are stronger as a result. So I'm really looking forward to the kinds of things that he has to share with us tonight. And I use mindfulness myself, and I've taught anxiety groups and emotion regulation groups because I always say emotion regulation groups are for the client who wants to do one of two things. They either want to learn how to reduce their reactivity and the severity of the emotions that they're experiencing. They want to dial it down, so to speak, so that they won't be so flooded with feelings. Or they want to prevent it to some degree. They want to stop giving situations, people, and places the power to make them feel a certain way. And so through deep breathing and progressive relaxation, and visualization, and auto-hypnosis, and cognitive behavioral therapy, as well as some of the principles that come from 12-step use, you know, staying in the moment, doing it one day at a time, looking at what you can change, and letting go of the rest. When you practice some of those principles and you combine them with mindfulness, you are much more likely to feel in control of your life, which will, A, allow you to work on the things that you need to work on, and B, will allow you an opportunity to experience some joy, some peace, and some serenity in your life. And more than likely, if you grew up with an attachment problem, you didn't feel that peace and serenity at all. Now, I want you to put me in your phone. This is going to be the call-in number for tonight. That number is 646-595-3284. And, you know, that's the number you can call every week if you have a question for myself, for my guest. If you have a comment, if something applies to you, maybe you just want to share your story, you can always feel free to call. And you can email me at carolthecoach@AOL.com. Take a look at my sexual addiction website. That's sexhelpwithcarolthecoach.com, or you can go to my Carol the Coach website. You know, that's the website where I kind of take you to a higher level. Once you feel like you've done all the trauma work and you've got your life in pretty good control, then you may want to say, how do I take it to that next level? And going to that website is always a great place. I have over 600 blogs, and you can find out about anything. All right. I did get an email from an old listener. I hadn't heard from him in a while. And, you know, you can tell that he's been working hard, but he still, unfortunately, because I had talked with him once through Skype and he had emailed me several times, I happen to know that this man has a fairly serious sexual addiction. And he wrote me right after Christmas, and he said to me, "Hi, Carol. I'm feeling a little ashamed of this email I sent you earlier, or at least the person that I have been in that email. I wanted to recall it as I do not want in some way to expose you to the bad side of me. But I hope that being a sex counselor, you have seen it all before and are not shocked or saddened by it. As you can imagine, I would not want to expose or influence anyone with my bad habits." And it's interesting he said that because he was a voyeur, and he also was an exhibitionist. And so you know that that's two of the 10 types of sexual addiction. And I certainly didn't judge him. I know that these behaviors become compulsive, they're obsessive, and they're very, very difficult to control. He says, "I think I want to make a resolution not to watch any porn at all next year, but I have to be realistic and expect that I may do a little." Okay. Now, I need to tell, we'll just call him John. I need to tell John, in essence, he is a sex addict. He is having trouble controlling himself. And watching pornography is at least middle circle behavior, if not inner circle behavior, which means it's a gateway for increased pornography. So when he says, I have to be realistic and expect that I may do a little, he's setting himself up for failure. He says, "It really is overrated anyway, and my goal will be to reduce the anticipation and sensation I get from abstinence." Well, I like that goal, but he shouldn't set himself up thinking that he's going to watch just a little. "I will also try not to do any of the other stuff, visiting prostitutes, phone sex lines, or trying to meet up with strangers for sex. I think that wraps up all the possible bad stuff I could get into. I expect to have times of weakness when I get home and I'm angry from work. That combined with loneliness, occasional shame and depression, I know that I may need to inject myself with some bad sexual habits." Now, again, it sounds like he knows himself well, but the addict in him is convincing him that he can dabble in some of these behaviors. So as I told him before, and I'm going to tell him again, get yourself, I know you're in London, but get yourself to a good certified sexual addictions therapist. Get yourself to as many 12-step meetings as you can on sexual addiction. Find yourself a sponsor and start connecting to the men in the group. That's how, John, you'll be able to abstain from sexual addiction and develop the relationships that you want so badly in your life. And, John, at any point you can call me. The number is 646-595-3284. And thanks for sending me an email. You know, a lot of times my listeners will send emails that show a lot of progress. And sometimes they have questions, and sometimes they call me when they're super discouraged in themselves or their partners, and they just want to vent, and I get that. I know it's difficult to call because you're afraid someone will recognize your voice, but that's all right. You know, I always say if somebody's listening to the show, they probably have a similar problem, and what I know to be true more than anything is when I have a caller on the line, he or she is helping hundreds of other callers who are listening to the show, whether it be live or through iTunes or on the Blog Talk website itself. So I am super excited because I have got a renowned expert on the field of attachment disorder and trauma. And Dr. Caldwell, welcome to the Sex Addiction Show with Carol the Coach.
Thank you.
Yes, you have really been working hard on attachment and attachment theory. Tell me a little bit about that for anybody who may not, you know, as a clinician, I know what attachment is, but for our listeners out there that may not have ever heard of that word, explain what an attachment disorder is.
Okay, well, attachment theory was first really thought up by Dr. John Bowlby, a psychiatrist, who really came out of the tradition of Freud and ego psychology, but broke ways with that tradition by saying that the bond between a child and the child's parents was very important for development. And he was ridiculed at the time, actually. He was banned from conferences and wasn't allowed to publish in certain magazines. But his really prescient and important ideas have certainly been validated over the last century. And there's lots of research showing now that those early years, the relationship between a parent and child are very important for development of the brain and development of the person. And so when there are problems in that kind of early relationship, it can leave a lasting impression on development and can cause difficulties even well into adulthood.
Yes, I even understand that it can be very, very difficult when you've had those issues with attachment to get through it without getting some intensive help.
Yes, that's right. So
tell me,
John
how
Bowlby,
did you become interested in it?
Well, I became interested. I was in my psychiatry training program, and I became very interested in borderline personality disorder and began seeking out opportunities to treat people with this disorder, and, of course, learned that borderline personality disorder is highly associated with early trauma, and that led me to study trauma and the effects of trauma on a developing brain. And from there, I became very interested in attachment because it seemed to me that oftentimes the trauma that people experienced, it may not be the type of trauma, you know, like a disaster or a car accident, but it may be this kind of what we call the Meadows relational trauma, the kind of day-in and day-out relational issues that come up between a parent and child. And it may not be trauma with a capital T, but it might be the accumulation of little t traumas, things like abandonment, enmeshment, loss, divorce. These kinds of issues can really play an important role in the attachment relationship and form some patterns over the course of childhood that then can stick with a person well into adulthood. And then, like you said, it may take some professional help to first recognize those patterns and then hopefully to try and find some healthy ways to be in relationship with other people.
Yeah, and I know that certainly my bias is that a lot of people have been through divorce and abandonment and neglect and the little T traumas. And so that may have significantly interfered with their ability to form healthy attachments. Is that
That's
correct?
Right. Yeah. So think about it this way. When we come into the world, we are completely helpless. We have a few innate behaviors. We can cry. We can cling on and grasp. We can root and look for food and look for milk. And, of course, we can connect with other humans by, even in the very early months, we can start to make eye contact and make some contingent or reciprocal kind of social interactions. But we're just very dependent upon a wiser, stronger adult figure in order to survive. So that relationship has really come about through the process of evolution. that those young little creatures, those organisms that were able to form a firm attachment bond were more likely to survive and were more likely to pass on their genes. And then over the course of time, these attachment behaviors became kind of written into our biology and an important part of survival. So maintaining that relationship with the parent is critical for survival. So we have a lot of our brain dedicated to maintaining that social, that critical social relationship. And so even in very difficult circumstances, we will be driven to maintain relationship. And so if there's a parent who is not able to be there in the way that would be most optimal for the parent-child relationship, the child will have to negotiate that somehow because they have to remain in relationship in order to survive. And so children will come up with very creative ways to maintain relationships in suboptimal situations with parents who might be struggling with their own issues, who might be addicted to substances themselves, who might be struggling with mental illness, or who might be having relationship problems and unable to be there fully and completely for the child. So the children will find a way to maintain that relationship, but it's oftentimes not the healthiest type of relationship patterns they develop.
So can you give me an example of one of the ways that a child might do that in an unhealthy way?
You bet. So, for example, I have a video that I show when I do a talk, and it's a video of a research paradigm called the still face paradigm. And what they do in this research paradigm is they have mother and baby interacting normally. And you see the mother and baby on a split screen, and they're having just this wonderful interaction back and forth, and baby's smiling, and mother is responding to the baby's cues, and the mother recognizes this little baby as having intentions and having a mind of his or her own. And there's this really wonderful kind of back and forth. And then there's a cue by the researcher for the mother to turn around, and she turns her face away from the baby. When she turns back towards the baby, she is supposed to have a still face, a non-emotional face. And you can see in the video how quickly the baby notices that something has changed in the dynamic. And right away, the infant is able to tell something is not right, just by what's happening to the mother's facial expression. And then from there, the baby does a number of things. First of all, the baby tries to distract itself and tries to look away or tries to find something in the room to play with. Then the baby becomes very distressed and begins to cry, lets out a high-pitched scream, and puts its hands right in front of the mother's face, like, look at me, please pay attention to me. And eventually, of course, the researchers allow the mom to then re-enter into a relationship with the infant, and the infant in this video does a very good job of returning back into relationship. But you can imagine that if there was repeated situations over and over, day in and day out, where a mother was distant, was not there, was unavailable, that the child would need to do something to deal with the pain and the heartache and the fear of not having that parent there. So one route that a child can go is they can kind of shut down their own attachment system. So they start to learn, when I reach out and ask for help, I don't get the help, and sometimes I even get dismissed or I get in trouble for doing this. So that they start discounting, dismissing, and down-regulating their attachment system. That is the real root of the avoidant attachment style, or sometimes called love avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other main dimension of attachment is, you can imagine that a baby might make a real fuss in that situation, trying to get the parents' attachment and get the parents' attention. So they might cry. They might actually ramp up the attachment system. They might hyperactivate all those attachment behaviors, crying, grasping, clinging, holding on to, don't leave me, don't go away, please be here. That is really at the root of the anxious or preoccupied attachment style. So those styles are really meant to actually make the best of a difficult situation. That child is doing its very best to negotiate a suboptimal situation. And over time, if that pattern is in place, then you can imagine that the biology around social relationships really develops around that pattern between the parent and the child. And so the child grows up learning to either downregulate their attachment system when they get close to somebody or hyperactivate the attachment system in order to keep somebody close by. And that really can carry on into adulthood, and we can see that play out in adult relationships, romantic relationships.
Well, that makes so much sense. And then, obviously, if they downregulate, they become love avoidant. And if they hyperactivate, they're anxious and preoccupied and probably obsessed with relationships in general, never feeling like they got their needs met.
Exactly.
And in actuality, would you believe I saw that same video? And I was so amazed. You could tell that the mother and the child were very, very, very healthy. And you're right. Within seconds, when she turned away, that child began to decompensate. And I think mother reintroduced herself, didn't she, by then playing patty cake and really re-engaging. And I thought to myself, so many of our listeners and the patients that we work with have had traumatized childhoods where there was divorce and alcoholism and drug abuse. And really, even if the parent was physically there, they weren't there for them emotionally. And and so what happens? Our clients develop some of these maladaptive coping skills to either gain attention from somebody or, you know, to protect themselves. So I want to ask you, what do you think attachment looks like in adulthood? You know, do our own childhood attachment experiences influence romantic relationships and parenting?
Certainly they do. Now, there's not always a one-to-one relationship between the child attachment patterns and the adult attachment patterns, but those early formative years do seem to set a trajectory. Now, there are certain things that can move a person on or off of that trajectory into adulthood. So, for example, a grandparent might be present in the child's life and may be enough of an attachment figure to help kind of buffer that kind of negative trajectory and keep them from going down the road of an adult attachment disorder. On the other hand, we see a lot of people, for example, who may have had some early childhood relational trauma, and then they seem to maybe find a way to make a positive relationship with a parent. But then in the teenage years, they might have a sexual assault, for example, and that will really affect the trajectory. And in adulthood, and this has been really the area of my specialty in my research. I've worked with Phil Shaver, who is one of the world experts in adult attachment. And in adulthood, adult attachment is really studied in two different ways. One is by asking adults what their own childhood was like. And then by actually coding, you can videotape that interview, and by coding the responses, more specifically, by coding the coherence of the narrative by which they talk about their early childhood experiences. This is, I think, fascinating. So if you ask them, for example, so what was how would you describe your mother? The coherence of the narrative when they describe their mother can tell us a lot about their attachment style. In fact, they did a study, they've done this study repeatedly, and for parents who were pregnant, they hadn't even had a child yet, they did this interview asking them about their own childhood, and then they coded the narrative, and the emotional response to those questions about their childhood before their child was born predicted the attachment to that child. So the way that we feel about our own attachment experiences in childhood means a lot for our relationships with our children, which, you know, is not very surprising to many of us.
So what kind of correlates did they see?
So they found that if you ask, for example, an adult, you say, so tell me about your mother, and if the adult says, well, you know, my mother was an alcoholic, but it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, it wasn't that important to me anyway. I really got along just fine. I didn't need her that much. It just made me stronger. That's a very dismissive style, a very avoidant style. And that correlates with the child then having an avoidant attachment, because the parent is dismissive of closeness, dismissive of close emotions and relationships. On the other hand, if you asked an adult, tell me about your father, and the adult said, well, my father was a rageaholic, he was quite abusive, and over the course of answering the question, they became more and more worked up, and it was almost as if they were present with that trauma again, that they didn't have a way to regulate their emotions, and they were so worked up in the middle of answering the question that they might lose track of what they were saying. That is a very kind of anxious, preoccupied style, and that would be associated with attachment problems with their child. So that's one way that attachment is measured in adulthood, is by kind of measuring how people respond to questions about their own childhood attachment experiences. The other way is by actually measuring adult relationships, so actually asking questions to adults about how they move through romantic relationships emotionally. And those same two dimensions, the kind of avoidant and preoccupied or anxious style, seems to pop up in adult relationships as well.
Very interesting. And I'm just kind of curious, in your work at the Meadows, mm-hmm. do you find that there's one style that's more prevalent than the other?
That's a great question. We are just starting to do outcomes research at the Meadows, and so we will actually be able to measure this. We will be measuring attachment styles, or in other words, love avoidance and love addiction, as we call it at the Meadows. Mm-hmm. By the way, those terms are clinical terms that Pia Melody has been talking about for years. She's really the person behind the Meadows model. And so it was so wonderful to find that my years of research are really being honored in a clinical way at the Meadows. That's been very exciting. But we will be measuring this. My sense is that I think what we're seeing is probably many of our men who are coming in for sexual addiction. I know you have a lot of specialty in sex addiction.
Yeah.
I think many of our men who are coming in for treatment for sex addiction, my sense is that there is an avoidance style there, a fear of close intimacy, and even though they feel like they're having some form of intimacy through their acting out behavior, it really isn't true intimacy. And there is this is just purely anecdotal, my own perception, but I think I'm seeing a trend towards some of our men having a more avoidance style. And I tend to work primarily at the Meadows with women, and oftentimes women with a history of trauma. And I'm seeing a lot of anxious or preoccupied attachment style. Many of them come in needing help with love addiction. They will have a history of abusive relationships, unhealthy relationships, and a real difficulty letting go of those relationships. And at its core, the love addiction really has some issues around the person not feeling good enough, not having a lot of self-esteem, and really kind of filling that void with another person. And I'm seeing that in my group of women that I treat.
Well, that makes sense. And I have to say that with my clients and population, if a woman has a sexual addiction, she is love avoidant more often than not. But a love addict, which is both men and women, I'm seeing more and more men that are falling into that category. Mm. They're definitely anxious and preoccupied, so I would support that research totally.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it shows up as a young person grows into an adult. And obviously you're seeing this in combination with other addictions, whether it be drugs, alcohol, or sex addiction.
That's right.
Now,
yeah.
I know that you've been interested in the link between attachment and emotion. Can you say a little bit more about that link?
Yeah, that's been one of my areas of research. So I've been really interested in how, because we really learn, so our brain really develops within a social context. And we learn so much about emotion and how to regulate emotion in the context of our close relationships. And so it became a very interesting question to me about, could we learn something about how people regulate emotions by studying their attachment style? And so I've done a couple of studies now that have been published looking at this question. We did a study of about 380 young people, asking them about their romantic relationship style, attachment style, and about the way that they regulate emotion. And what we found is, in accordance with the attachment theory, that people who had a avoidant attachment style tended to suppress their emotions. They tended to have very little clarity about what they were feeling, about the antecedents to their emotions, about what precipitated the emotions. And they just didn't have a lot of clarity about what was going on emotionally with them. And
so
they had a hard time.
So the attachment style that was a problem also showed up in the emotions. They were detached
right.
from their own emotions and how it affects them both body-wise and with their mind.
That's exactly right. You know, which, of course, you know, doesn't surprise us a lot, but it's always great to do a study with a large number of people and find that's, in fact, what we find. So these folks also had difficulty regulating negative emotion. So even though they suppress their emotion, they actually have done research on this where on the outside, when looking at somebody who has this kind of avoidant style and who is suppressing emotion, they look calm. But if you actually measure their brain, if you measure what's happening in their brain, their amygdala, their limbic system, that kind of reptilian emotional center in their brain is firing off rapidly. So they may look calm and they may be suppressing outward emotion, but inside they're really struggling with their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the emotional style of somebody who's more avoidant attachment. In our
study, fascinating that would still have that internalized effect.
Right.
Because you would think that they would it would become so predictable that it wouldn't light up or fire up that internalized central nervous system response. But truly what you're saying is that they're feeling it inside, but they're not showing it.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you take, if you measure skin conductance, that's the amount of kind of sweating they're doing or the heart rate, some of those physiological parameters, those measures will pick up on this. So even though what they've learned is not to show emotion in the relationship because they don't like to show vulnerability.
Right.
Because their experience was that by showing their attachment needs, by showing their vulnerability, they were either dismissed or they were sometimes punished for that. And so they've learned this pattern of, you know, deactivate the attachment system, kind of disconnect, put up walls, wall myself in, be protected. But inside, there's a lot going on emotionally for them.
Mm, okay. And so then, obviously, the anxious or preoccupied person.
Right. So we found in our study.
How they show up in that study, yeah.
Yeah, we found that these folks, as you might expect, they rated themselves as being very high in rumination. So they tend to think rapidly and go over things in their mind, especially negative thoughts over and over and over in their mind. It's like the negative thoughts, they can't quite let go of them. And oftentimes those negative thoughts are about themselves. Whereas the avoidant attachment style is often about, I can't trust this other person, so I'm going to keep my distance. The anxious style is, something's wrong with me, and if people get close to me, they're going to leave me. They're going to abandon me. So these folks are oftentimes ruminating about their negative qualities. They're they report having a lot of negative affect, so a lot of guilt and anxiety and shame and anger. And then they, too, have a hard time regulating negative emotion. So the interesting thing that came out in the study was that both groups have a hard time regulating negative emotion, and both groups rated themselves as being lower in resilience. But they got to those qualities in different ways. The avoidant people got there by suppressing emotion and not having a lot of clarity about their emotions, whereas the anxious people got there by ruminating and by having a lot of negative affect. And this really fits with the attachment style, one of deactivating the attachment system and the other of hyperactivating it.
Well, that makes sense. And so your work with mindfulness is a way to directly affect that acknowledgement of what's going on.
That's right. This is a very new, cutting-edge field of research. In fact, it's now become a field of neuroscience research, and it's called contemplative neuroscience. And really started with the many scientists here in the West being interested in Tibetan Buddhism and in meditation. And there's been, of course, as you've seen in the news, these talks between the Dalai Lama and Western scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And my mentor in my PhD program, Phil Shaver, was invited to Tibet as one of the scientists to present to the Dalai Lama. And as,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and it's kind of an interesting side story. So he told me about this meeting, and he was there in the this large monastery with the Dalai Lama and a whole room full of other monks, and they had PowerPoint connected in front of all these monks and a large screen, and they were teaching their various research fields to these monks. And my mentor has studied attachment for his whole career. So he started talking about attachment, and the Dalai Lama stopped the translators at attachment. And he said, well, we really try and strive for non-attachment, you know, but not being attached to things. And so there was a bit of a translation issue about what attachment really meant. And once the Dalai Lama understood that it was a close, secure, and safe relationship between people, then the Dalai Lama described his relationship with his own mother. And my mentor looked at him and said, you were fortunate enough to have a secure attachment with your mother. So as an interesting side note, the Dalai Lama likely had a secure attachment, which makes a lot of sense given his life and all the amazing things
he's done. And his wisdom and
his
intuitiveness. And
right.
Yeah, he's
at
amazing.
Any rate, this area is a new area, this interface between mindfulness, meditation, and attachment. And it's become an interest of mine. I've been practicing and studying mindfulness for a number of years. But as we talked about a moment ago, about these two kind of pathways from attachment insecurity, one being avoidance and one being anxious, and then going to emotion dysregulation and poor resilience, it seems to me that a nice kind of middle-of-the-road approach to the hyperactivating strategy with anxious attachment and the deactivating strategy with avoidant attachment is mindfulness. It really represents that kind of non-judgmental, compassionate, middle-of-the-road approach where one is not avoiding the situation like in avoidant attachment and not becoming worked up about it like in anxious attachment style. And so I've become interested in whether or not the practice of mindfulness in everyday life could, and especially as it is applied to attachment, could help to ameliorate, to improve some of these emotion regulation strategies associated with attachment insecurity.
Well, you know, yes, exactly, because I was thinking how if mindfulness represents the compassion, and that's compassion towards self, because you think these are two types of people that did not have the significant ego bonds and strengths with people that they loved, and therefore they really kind of have to depend on themselves. And, boy, mindfulness helps you to totally be dependent on yourself to experience what's going on in the moment.
I agree. That's very well put. I totally agree. There's something about it's really hard to have intimacy if we're not able to be present with ourselves, to be present with what's going on inside of us. You know, I'm a parent, and I've been married 18 years, and I know when I take the low road in parenting, it almost always has something to do with what's going on with me. It usually has very little to do with my child and what they have done. Almost always, there's something going on inside of me that I'm not able to be present with and not able to kind of drop into and say, what's going on right now, and can I really accept what's going on right now? That's usually when I take the low road in parenting, when I take the low road in my relationship with my wife, oftentimes there's something going on with me. So this is really about a technique, you know, you can call it mindfulness, but people have been doing this kind of technique for, you know, eons and called it various things. It's really about learning to pause, learning to take some time before reacting, dropping into our body, letting our body guide us a little bit as to what's going on, and then questioning what's here, what is really here, and can I be with it? Can I bring some non-judgment, some compassion to it, and just be with this and stay with this a little while before, you know, getting into reactivity, which is so easy to do. That type of approach could really mean a lot for our relationships, I think.
Oh, 100%, as well as it really allows the person that's asking those questions a mechanism by which to detach from some of the emotional reaction and still be very present for him or herself and the other person.
That's right. Yeah, that's very right. It's that observing self that we sometimes talk about in therapy, or an observing perspective, being able to step back a little bit from the situation. This is something I really try and help my clients with at the Meadows, and a lot of what we do at the Meadows has a very, it ties in very nicely with attachment and with mindfulness. But I try and help them to learn to pause and to step back a little bit. A phrase that's helped me, and I think has helped some of my clients, is if we can recognize the ocean within ourselves, then we can tolerate the, you know, the waves that come through in life. You know, it's so easy to get caught on these waves of life and get pulled along and tossed about. But if we can back up and be a little bit vaster, a little bit broader, and recognize the ocean, then we can tolerate the waves within us. And
so
you know, that's what I try and help my clients.
If I understand you correctly, I hear you saying that if you've experienced child maltreatment or attachment disturbances as a child, that there is hope for a person to experience healthy relationships if they are willing to work on themselves, work on mindfulness, work on their emotion regulation, and maybe develop the skills that build trust and intimacy and focus.
Yes, I agree. That's right. Now, you're exactly right. There's a lot that can be done, for example, in an adult romantic relationship to help each other to feel more secure in the relationship. That's very important. But there's also a lot of relationship skills, right? I mean, just practical skills around communication, around roles and how we move through our day and childcare, all these things are important too. But if we're not feeling safe in the relationship, if we don't feel like this person will be there when we need them and we can ask for our needs to be met and they'll listen to that and try, then, you know, then it's hard to get a lot of work done. So this attachment work is really about helping a couple to create some safety and security within the relationship so that they can start putting in place those more practical tools.
So at the Meadows, I would assume that you work with people individually and you work with them in groups and you may even work with them as a couple.
We do. Yep, we have a 5-week program that is just a wonderful model, again, designed by Pia Melody, and that has been around for, we've been around for 35 years. And we do a lot of work around family of origin issues, relational trauma, and even trauma in adulthood. We do intensive work around addiction, addictions of all kinds. And then we have a family week process where family members, spouses, they come in. And we don't just do a tour of the facility. This is pretty intensive family work. And I would say almost universally, people, the family members at the end of that week tell me, this has been so helpful for us to do this work. And they say things like, everybody should have an opportunity to do this kind of work. And that's just so rewarding to hear that. We really, I think, do some very good work with families. And a lot of it is around communication, helping people to feel safe, learning to recognize cues in the other person, so that they know, you know, when to back away and when to move in, all those kinds of things.
Well, you know, I stay with my husband because it is a safe environment, that when we're arguing, when we're disagreeing, if he will let me touch him, it automatically puts us focused on each other. We're in the moment, and there's a special connection that occurs no matter what anybody is saying, and it just automatically brings down the defensiveness.
Isn't
now, I
wonderful?
Know for some clients, they can't do that because it's not safe. But, you know, there are some amazing tools that you can graduate towards that are so simplistic but really make a huge difference in how one communicates and how one feels about oneself.
You bet. I
love
that.
Now, let me ask you,
because
you received a research award to study mindfulness, and can you just tell us a little bit about that and what you're doing?
Yes. From the International Society of Traumatic Stress Studies, they have an annual conference, and the conference was in L.A. this year. And I was fortunate enough to receive one of their research grants to study mindfulness as an intervention for women who have experienced childhood trauma.
Mm.
And the type of intervention that I'm planning to do is a workshop. And it will combine information about attachment, child attachment, and adult attachment, as well as some practical techniques for regulating emotion using mindfulness. And we're hoping to pilot the workshop this spring, and we're actually going to measure some outcomes so we can see if it's been effective. So we're very excited about this.
Well, I bet you are, and I just have to say that my only hope is that you get more grant money so that you can do this with men too, because they are so wounded, and they're looking for coping skills. And you know, I've done over 2,000 groups for women, and have adored that population, but I'm really amazed at how men are just craving more coping skills so that they can develop the relationship skills that they know they've never had, ever. So keep working on that research grant, because we need men to get some of these things too. As a matter of fact, I was talking with a man today who had been released from a treatment center, and he was creating a structure for himself now that he's home, you know, and it's going to involve 90 meetings in 90 days, and he's coming to my sexual addiction group. And he said, you know, I may need, he's an exec, but he said, I may need to live in a halfway house because the cravings still continue, and I need more support than what I'm getting. And as we were exploring this, he said to me, I was asking him, does he intellectually make decisions? Does he do it based on his emotions, or does he base it on his intuition? And he said, well, I don't listen to my intuition very often, but when I do, it tells me to become mindful. And when I become mindful, the right things happen for me. And I said, this is a man who really has that intuitive sense that he knows exactly what he needs. He's just not sure how to go about it. So we explored a mindfulness course that he's taking a look at right now, a 15-week course, just so he can get quiet with himself and really work on some of these strategies.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It was such an important part of my recovery to really... I remember actually getting out of therapy. I was a psychiatric resident, and I was in individual therapy with my therapist. And I got out of therapy and got in my car and immediately turned on my radio and just got busy. And something, there was just this moment of clarity that said, you know, John, just slow down, turn off your radio, and be with yourself a little bit. And so I turned off my radio, and on my drive back to the hospital, I just sat with myself and my feelings that had come up during therapy. And that for me was really the start for kind of an awakening. And, you know, I've really come to appreciate that. You can call it mindfulness. There's lots of, I don't like even getting too stuck into labeling it, but just a way of really learning to be with ourselves has been so important to me. And part of that process has been using the body, learning to be comfortable in my own body and using the body as a way, as a guide, really, to let me know what I'm feeling and to be able to track emotions through the body. This is something that we try and do a lot of at the Meadows, and I just see it being so helpful for people.
Well, I want to ask you the million-dollar question, which is, as you sat in your car and you talked to yourself and you said, just be still and pay attention to what's going on and get quiet, do you remember the feeling that was connected to that?
Yeah, I remember being afraid.
Uh-huh. Well, I always say there's five primary feelings, and they're anger, sadness, loneliness, fear, and happiness. And what I heard in your voice was sadness, but it makes sense that it was really fear.
Yeah, underneath that was this fear of, you know, not really knowing what was there. If I was really to open to what was there, what would I find?
Mm-hmm.
And there was really this fear about, you know, what if I slow down and really pay attention to what's underneath all this busyness? What am I going to find there? Is there something worthwhile there to find? And I'm happy to say that really taking the time and making the effort to be with myself and even with the difficult aspects of myself, underneath there, with those kind of hard-to-look-at aspects, were some really wonderful, tender aspects that I just felt so blessed to be able to come into contact and to have re-contact with.
That you had the courage to practice what you preach, and that can be very tough for professionals. And
that's right.
It sounds like you've devoted your entire life to this. Listen, we're getting close to the end of the show, but I do want to remind people that if they want to read some of your articles you've written for The Meadows, they can go to www.addictionrecoveryreality.com. And then your own personal website, can you give us that?
Yes, it's www.drjohncaldwell. That's D-R-J-O-N, last name C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L.com.
Well, it has been a pleasure, Dr. Caldwell, because I can tell that, you know, part of your great wisdom is your ability to be genuine and straightforward and compassionate. So thank you so much for helping our listening audience today hear about mindfulness, hear about attachment theory, and encourage them to take better care of themselves by recognizing their relationship skills and also the coping strategies they can use to get to know themselves better. Thank you so very much.
Carol, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure of mine.
Well, I appreciate it, and hopefully we will meet soon.
I hope so.
Okay. You take care. Have a great week.
Take care. You too.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, that was Dr. John Caldwell. He is an expert in the field of attachment theory. Amazing work he's doing. And can you imagine how that must be to work with people, work with their trauma, whether it's the little T or the big T, and then assist them in getting clear about what has occurred in their life and what they can do to get more grounded, focused. It makes all the difference in the world in terms of how they relate to themselves, to other people, and even in the program. You know, I was talking to a man today who said in our group that he was looking to find his purpose, and my assignment to him was for the next 30 days, he was to sit with a piece of paper and a pen and just ask his God, his higher power, the universe, whatever, but for him it was God, what would you like me to do? What is my purpose? And I guaranteed him that if he was still, the answer would come to him, and then we would help him formulate that in group, because everybody deserves a support system. And I have so much gratitude for you all for listening to the show. I want to encourage you to contact me at www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach or through carolthecoach@aol.com. Keep listening to the show, and make sure you go to iTunes and download all the 40 or so shows that we've had in the past year. I want you to have a great week, and as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all time. Fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. And a great big thank you to Dr. Caldwell and the Meadows. And we will see you next week. Talk to you later.